Hello there, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast, latest installment of Truncat, the somewhat sequel to Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. This is the final installment of that story. Very exciting and very hectic around here. The Worldcon starts tomorrow, and I teach my first class at the University of Southern California today, so it's all been a bit of a marathon lately. I hope I'll see some of you at the Worldcon. I'm going to read a little from Little Brother, the young adult novel I've written about the Department of Homeland Security that some of you have heard me talk about here on this podcast. So I'm going to read from that for an hour or so at the Worldcon and do some signings and so on. And of course, my big stomach churner is that I'm up for the Hugo Award for the story I, Robot, that you might have heard on this podcast. A kind of send-up-slash-critique-slash-re-examination of Asimov in light of today's totalitarian trends in computer design. The other bits of news, of course, if you read Boing Boing or Craphound, you will have seen that a company called WebSense that provides censorship software for the internet to schools and corporations that want to limit what their internet users can see. I've criticized them on Boing Boing, and they apparently have retaliated against me by blocking access to my podcast for their customers. They've classified my podcast as software download, and of course, software download is something that most IT managers don't want happening on their network, so that's pretty much the kiss of death. I couldn't get them to comment on it, but it's pretty much the only thing hosted at the Internet Archive they've classed that way, so it seems pretty clear to me anyways that it's punitive. And then the other bit of news is, of course, I start teaching tomorrow, and many of you have written to me to wish me good luck and asked me if I will do a podcast of the lectures or the classes. And I thought about it really hard, and I've decided not to do that for a couple of reasons. But the biggest one is that I want the students in this seminar, which is going to be a seminar about DRM, to feel really free to speak. And I think that wiretapping them is probably not the best way to do that. If it were a bigger class that were more lecture format, which I'm going to be teaching one of those in the second semester, I feel a lot more comfortable. But I think a little intimate group of people, the last thing they want is a tape recorder in the middle of the room, recording their every thought and maundering for permanent posterity. So I'm not going to podcast it. But the good news is that I'm bringing in a series of speakers who I'm also interviewing for my nonfiction book about DRM. I'm going to be bringing them in over the course of the year, and they're going to give public talks at USC, and I'm definitely going to podcast those public talks in the Q&A. Those will be open to the public, and I'll have those in the podcast feed. So without further ado, here is the final installment of Truncat. It was tough squeezing two people into the buoy, but they managed to clamber in with much blushing and inadvertent placement of hands and elbows. Adrian's sexual experiences to date had been entirely teledildonic, and the reality of his close proximity to someone of the opposite sex had his ears glowing pink. Tina took it all in stride, remarking that she'd been in much closer quarters aboard the ship she'd grown up on, bending time and space in the long voyage out to what turned out to be a hunk of dead, airless rock. "It's pretty cool for Earth, though," she allowed. Adrian covered his embarrassment by furiously combing the network for some decent bootlegs. Though not officially one of the million, Tina was a generational comrade, and entitled to try out flashbaking under the terms of the agreement that Mohan had insisted the million subscribe to if they wanted access to his booty. Adrian's researches had located a real plum, and the revolutionary's backup, trunk to a mere nubbin of its former glory, but still a good choice for Tina's first experience. He downloaded it from a boy in Vancouver and pushed it into Tina's public directory. She cast her eyes up, and they tracked over her HUD. "What's this?" she asked. "It's what I do," Adrian said, and sent her the flashbaking app. "We'll run it together." Together, they executed the app, rolling the bootleg and baking it. Adrian suppressed a groan of disappointment. The file was so foreshortened that it barely registered with him, just a distant hurrah of triumph, and then it was gone. Tina, though, was completely taken aback, her breathing heavy, her jaw hanging limp. Slowly, her almond eyes fluttered open, and she rolled her head from side to side languorously. "That was really fine," she said. "Really. How do you know Nestor?"
"Who?"
"The guy in the backup. Nestor. He was on the ship with us." Adrian's heart slammed into his chest. "You know him?"
"Yeah," she said. "Of course. I grew up with him."
Adrian reeled. She knew the revolutionary. He could meet him, get another copy of the bootleg.
"Wait, you don't know Nestor?" she said. He shook his head, his mind racing. He would meet him. Go with him to see Mohan, tell him their theories about the million. "How did you get this if you don't know Nestor?" she asked. His thoughts screeched to a halt. "It's a bootleg," he said, "an illicit copy." She gave him a hard look, and he realized what was weird about her eyes, her skin. She'd been tin-plated, iron-lunged, and steely-eyed all her life until she made Earth. She'd only had naked eyes for a few days. Now they looked steely, distant, and considering. "You're saying that you got this without Nestor's permission?" she asked. So he explained about the bootlegs, about Mohan's discovery of a back door that let him designate his personal storage with the generic ID used for the system's discard bin, how Mohan had distributed the backups over the handshaking channel. He was warming up to a discussion of the generational politics when she interrupted him. "That's awful," she said. "These are private. How can you just trade them around?" He hadn't actually given it any thought in years. "It's not like we're spying on our friends," he said hastily. "These people are strangers. We'll never know who they are. But it's the only way we can learn about..." "Nestor's not a stranger," she said flatly. "He ran the engine room on my ship. He won't like this very much either." "Wait," Adrian said, alarmed. "You're not going to tell him, are you? We could get into a lot of trouble." "You mean you could get into a lot of trouble," she said. "Fine," he said hotly. "Go ahead. That's what I get for making friends with a stranger." That stopped her. "We are friends?" she said. "Sure," he said. "You're the only person I've ever brought here. That's friendship, isn't it?" "But you just met me," she said. "How can you be my friend?" She seemed genuinely distressed. "Well, I just liked you is all," he said. "You asked me good questions. I thought I could ask you some. I showed you this place. Let you flashbake one of my bootlegs." "And that makes us friends?" she shook her head. "On the ship, we treated everyone like that. Friends were really..." She dug for the word. "It wasn't so casual. Friends were a big deal." "You see," Adrian said, glad to be off the subject of the bootlegs, "that's just the kind of thing that makes us great friends. You don't know your way around Earth, and I don't know much about space, so we've got lots to talk about. What were friends like on the ship?" And off they went, and at first Adrian was just relieved. But she had wonderful stories. Stories of bravery and devotion, of friends scattered to the stars, seas and earth when the ship returned to Earth, of the hollow longing she felt for them now. Before he knew it, it was nightfall, and he'd located another bootleg, fresh from Mohan, and they flash-baked it and agreed that having the whole file was better than just some little stub of a truncat. But that being said, her friend Nestor had had a much more interesting life than the 80-year-old painter they'd just run. When they parted for the night, Adrian took her hand and told her what a wonderful time he'd had with her. "Could you do me a favor, do you think?" "Sure," she said brightly. "Could you hold on to some files for me?" If she'd hesitated, even for an instant, he would have taken it back, told her not to bother. He wasn't a bastard. She was really cool, the first person his age he'd been in company with in years, just wonderful to hang with. She didn't hesitate, not even for an instant. "Sure," she said, and he moved all the bootlegs he'd picked up that afternoon into her storage. Adrian wasn't really sure what physically proximate friends did for fun, but Tina had all sorts of ideas. They met up for breakfast the next morning at a public maker near Adrian's place, and the queue had never seemed shorter as they gabbled in the near silence of the thronged corridor. While they shoveled post-scarcity waffles and sausage into their mouths, Tina remarking constantly on the crowds, the sheer thronging humanity of it all. The parks were all too dense for fun, but they found ample elbow room way out in the East End, where untalented sculptors operated public studios in unpopular former scrapyards. The fight was Adrian's fault. "I want to meet him," Adrian said, as they watched a man with a hammer and chisel crawl over a hideous marble lion. "Him?" Tina said. "Why? He stinks." Adrian smiled and shushed her. "Not so loud. Anyways, he's not as bad as some of the people around here." "But not him. Nestor, the ship's engineer. You know." Her expression slammed shut. "No, God, no. Adrian, why?" She choked on whatever she was going to say next. Adrian, taken aback, said carefully, "Why not? I mean, I really, you know, admire him." "But you've been inside his head," she said, scandalized. "How could you look him in the eye after..." Again, words failed her. "But that's why I want to meet him. What I saw, what he knows, it just makes so much sense. I feel like he could really tell me what it's all about."
Her eyes took on the aspect of steel again, the million light-year stare. If you talk to Nestor, I'll never speak to you again. I'll turn you in. I'll report you and all of your pals. Jesus, Tina, what's wrong with you? You're supposed to be my friend, and now you're going to turn me in? He was so angry he could hardly speak. He wished he was talking to her over the network so that he could just hang up and walk away. He did the next best thing, turning on his heel and walking. Hey, Tina shouted, angry too. He kept on walking. She found him in his private place, holding a one-sided argument with his mother. Mom, I'm old enough to get a place of my own, and you can't stop me, he shouted into the buoy's guts. In her cochlea, he heard his mother's grunt of anger, and his HUD was filled with the scrolling system log as she angrily deleted his files, being on a particularly nasty tear that day. Mom, he shouted again, talk to me or I'll lock you out. Tina watched this, half in, half out of her buoy, her bottom exposed to the frigid, stinging rain, her face flushed with the captured body heat in the buoy. Adrian had yet to notice her, too absorbed in his conversation. That's it, he said. I'm locking you out now. He opened his eyes and sighed back against the buoy's bulkhead. He saw Tina and let out a surprised, "Ah!" He recovered quickly, gave her a nasty look, and said, "Get out! Jesus, just leave me alone!" She'd been calling him, leaving messages on his voicemail for a week, but he had her blocked and the messages just kept on getting returned, unheard. Defiantly, she crawled the rest of the way in and huddled as far from him as she could, which meant that she was still halfway in his lap. God, they must be stupid in space, Adrian ranted. Can't you understand that I don't want to talk to you? Go away! Tina gave him an appraising look. One thing we learn in space, she said, is how to outwait a bad mood. I'm not leaving until we have a chance to talk, and if you don't like it, that's too bad. You're not getting rid of me unless you throw me into the lake. Adrian fumed and closed his eyes. He searched fruitlessly for a decent bootleg, but his connections had dried up and dropped off in the 2 weeks since his mother's spot checks had curtailed his trading. It would take days to build them up again. Fine, he said at length. Say your piece and go, all right? Turn on public access, Tina said. Adrian started to protest, but she fixed him with her stare. Do it, she said, firmly. Adrian sighed dramatically and closed his eyes, then watched as all the bootlegs he'd stored with her were passed back to his storage. Everything. Thanks, he said, cautiously. What's going on? Are you planting evidence before turning me in? She shook her head. I deserve that, I suppose. There's one more, she said, and a file name appeared in his HUD. What is it, he said. Just try it, she said. He rolled it up and baked it, then grunted in shock. It was Nestor's backup, complete and whole, centuries of life, stretching up to the current day. There was Tina in the memories, her birth on the ship, her growing up. There was the voyage, the long trip taken in vain, and the long return home. The new memories were mirror bright and cold as space, all the vigor and passion drained with nothing but a hard waiting in their place. He opened his eye. Where? He began, but he couldn't finish. He waved his hands at her. Tina grinned wryly. I took it from the ship, she said. I still have access to its utility files. It's just past Pluto now, spacing out for another mission. That made it a little tricky to transfer, but I got it. Thanks, he said. She tilted her head. Don't thank me, she said. It was sinking in now, that hardness, that waiting. The centuries ahead, dull and indistinguishable from the ones behind, and no hope of it ever ending. The miserable, fatal knowledge that there was only more of this, more and more, forever, and no break in the monotony. It settled over him like lead weight, sapping everything, even the anger of his mother. Endless days of plenty. How did he get so... We used to say he was arid, Tina said. None of the parents on the ship would let the kids go near him, so of course we snuck over to see him whenever we could. He hasn't had a rejuve in, forever, and he looks like a silver skeleton. We'd pester him with questions, and he'd just stare and stare, then finally say something so amazingly depressing. But how? he was so passionate. He made me feel like there was a chance, like I could make a difference, Adrian said. That first bootleg, it must have dated back to before the ship left, a relative century before, and it was flushed into Mohan's honeypot when the ship returned and Nestor made a fresh backup. Tina shrugged. Space changes people, she said, simply. Time, too. He's nearly 400 now, you know. My parents called him a post-person. You know, what comes after people. That's why we didn't ship out again. They don't want that to happen to them. Nestor wasn't the only one. Adrian shuddered. A ship full of people like that, years cooped up in quarters tighter than any he'd known on Earth? You see why I didn't want you to meet him, she said. Oh, I can take care of myself, he said. You don't have to worry about me. She gave him another quizzical look. Her glance was more natural now, less spacey. Her skin, too, had taken on a tone that was more human. I wasn't worried about you, she said. I was worried about Nestor. He's okay most of the time, but when you get him talking about the old days, he just breaks down. You've never seen anyone so miserable. Poor old Nestor, she said, with feeling. Say, I've got one more for you, if you're interested, she said. Brand new, she added. Sure, Adrian said, and opened his directory. He took the file he found there, rolled it, baked it. It was Tina, the short life of Tina, the claustrophobia and unimaginable distances of space, the tight and deep friendships in the tiny shipboard community, the loneliness in the crowds of Earth, her spying on him in the streets of this strange and overwhelming city, her relief when he didn't rebuff her, and him through her eyes, smart and savvy and frightening. Frightening? Yes, his anger and his rejection, his unfathomable values and ideas. It was short, her backup, a mere 17 years worth of consciousness, and it took him a bare moment to bake it. Tina was looking down at her feet. Hey, Adrian said. Tina? Tina looked up. She was scared, those eyes wide and guileless. Yes, she said. Switch on guest access, okay? Adrian said. Then he pushed her a copy of his last backup. He spent as long as he could bumming around downtown before catching the subway home. His mother hadn't called him since he'd locked her out of his personal storage, and he sent her a copy of his backup and the flash baking app, and the thought of seeing her face to face made his stomach knot. Leadenly, he took the stairs down to the subterranean level where his family slept and hit the door code. It slid open, revealing his father alone, staring up at the ceiling. Dad, Adrian said. His cochlea rang. He answered. Hi, Adrian, his father said in his ear. He sounded tired. Where's Mom? Adrian asked, with a growing sense of foreboding. Oh, she went out, Adrian's father said vaguely. Is she angry? Adrian expected a chuckle. But none came. No, his father said flatly. Not angry. Are you angry? His father shifted his bulk and drew Adrian into a long hug. No, son, I'm not angry either, he whispered aloud in Adrian's ear. It took Adrian a moment to register that his father had spoken aloud, and when he did, it hardly eased his nervousness. What's going on, Dad? He asked, finally. His father sat up, ducking his head for the low ceiling. I owe you an apology, he said. For what? His father switched back to subvocal. All that business with the university. You deserve to choose what you want to do. We had a long talk about it this afternoon, and we decided it's not our place to tell you what to study. I'll take you in to see Bosco in the morning, and we can show him the essay you worked up with your friend in India. Adrian didn't know what to make of that, except that he felt vaguely guilty. Why? What changed your mind? His father flopped onto his back and stared at the ceiling. I read the paper, he said. It's good. Interesting thesis. Good execution. Thought-provoking. It's a good paper. You could really start something with it. Yeah, Adrian said, blushing. His HUD flashed an alert. His father was pushing a file into his storage. Adrian examined it. A backup. His father's backup. Adrian understood now. He knew that if he looked in his father's storage, he'd see a copy of his own backup there. Yes, you and your friends, you could have a real destiny. Post people, the last generation on Earth. That's smart stuff. Adrian startled. Post-person. He thought of Nestor, Saurian, purposeless, cold and hard, of Tina, looking for a job, a thing to do every day. A thought occurred to him. What are you going to do when I start school, Dad?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe deadhead for a while, see what things are like in another century. Don't know what your mother wants to do.
They'd talked about deadheading before, but Adrian had never really believed they'd do it. Gone for a century, frozen in cold sleep like millions of others, waiting to see what the future held.
I'll miss you, he said.
You'll get used to it, Adrian's father said. I can't tell you how many people I know who are deadheading now. Almost everyone I ever knew, really. We'll see each other again before you know it.
When he woke in the morning, his mother was back, asleep between him and his father. Automatically, he checked his inbox. His mother had sent him a copy of her backup, too. He got up quietly, careful not to disturb her, and snuck away. Tina answered on the second ring, sounding groggy.
Hello, Tina?
Tina?
Hi, she mumbled.
Listen, do you want a job, he said.
Huh?
She was waking up now.
A job? Do you still want a job?
Sure, she said.
You're hired, he said.
For what?
Adrian rolled up and flashed Nestor's backup, feeling the hopeless, hopeless weight of eternity. He flashed his mother's backup, his father's. He grinned.
Here, let me dump you the job requirements, he said, and dumped the files on her. Start with these. Send them around, everyone you know. Don't ask for anything in return, but if they send you anything back, pass that around, too.
He swallowed, prepared a set to send to Mohan.
We're going to be post people, but we are going to do it right, he said.